ID checking and rechecking was conducted by the Orwellian assembly of security agents at the gate. I spotted Mr. Leahy as a baby-faced army officer was at long last escorting me into the West Wing. At the end of a hallway, Leahy seemed locked in a heated argument with a staffer in front of a pair of closed double doors. A lot of military types kept coming in and out of the boardroom behind them. A lot of metal flashed on jackets. The staffer shook his head at Leahy emphatically and departed as I stepped up. "Something heavy-duty is going on, Oz," Leahy said, buttonholing me by the secretary's desk. "What's the problem?" I said. "They won't listen," the silver-haired NSA officer said, more to himself than to me. "I can't believe this. They won't even listen to me." "Who won't listen?" I said. Leahy tilted his head toward a nearby door. "Step outside." On the White House colonnade, Leahy shook out a pack of Marlboros. "I haven't smoked in 10 years, he said. He popped a match to life and held it to the tip of his cigarette. I wanted to shake him by the lapels. "You wanted me here, now I'm here, what's the problem?" He didn't answer. He took another drag, held the smoke in for a beat, and leisurely exhaled from his nose in twin gray streamers of smoke. Back in New York, my family was in jeopardy while this jackass pulled my chain. As Leahy put the cigarette to his lips again, I smacked it out of his hand. "Stop fucking around with me," I said. "What is the problem?" The military managed to convince the president that this thing can be taken care of with conventional weapons. They have satellite imagery of some animal nesting sites, and they want to use napalm on them. Imagine. They think they can bomb all the critters to kingdom come. They don't want to listen to reason anymore, Oz. They just want to trot out their toys. He shook out another cigarette. "To a hammer, everything is a nail," he said, and lit the cigarette. "But that's nuts, Leahy. Isn't President Hardinson known for being a moderate, a pragmatist, Mrs. Reasonable?" Leahy looked around the colonnade. "We're probably bugged. I should know, shouldn't I? But screw it. Who's around to listen? This is top secret, Oz. Mum's the word, understand? The president's daughter is dead." "Huh?" I did a double take. "What?" I said. "Allie?" Leahy nodded. "It's being kept out of the press for now. The way I heard it, she told the president that Dodger had run away, but he hadn't. She'd hidden him in a crawl space above the family's quarters. That's where they found her. The dog had, well, you can guess the rest." "Who found her?" "Secret Service. The president borrowed a gun from an agent and put the dog down herself. She's just not herself right now. She's signing everything the military puts in front of her." "Shit," I said. "Shit is right," Leahy said. "A shit is what they don't give about the fact that this is an environmental issue. They don't want to hear from any more scientists. They want blood, and they're going to get it." Chapter 76. MacDill Air Force Base, 4 miles south-southwest of Tampa, Florida. Air Traffic Control Officer Lieutenant Frank White stirs milk into the first coffee of his shift with studied nonchalance as he steps onto the main floor of the control tower. As he crosses the room to his station, the lanky 30-year-old is thinking ruefully about the fishing trip he was planning on taking this weekend, before the airwaves became a network of doomsday theories. He's focusing on trying to keep his eyeballs from rolling out of their sockets. MacDill is a backwater air refueling base, and his job is usually a cakewalk. The hardest part is trying to keep 23-year-old recruits with 30 hours flight time behind their wet ears from coming in too hot and turning the tarmac into a pizza oven. White blinks down at runway 1, where, for some reason, 2 dozen F-16 Falcons are powering up along the taxiway. He gawks as a black B-2 stealth bomber touches down on runway 2. "This is no fucking joke," he mumbles as he stands, still absentmindedly stirring his coffee. All the fighters are bristling with underwing ordnance. One of the aircraft maintenance engineers in the locker room swore that they are all incendiary in nature. Powdered aluminum thermite bombs, magnesium, white phosphorus. Said he couldn't be certain, but the B-2s looked like they were carrying thermobaric daisy cutters. Shit, White thinks. They could be goddamn nukes for all he goddamn knows. The encrypted chain of command phone by his radar station rings 20 minutes later. He's been drinking the coffee and is almost feeling half-conscious now. The orders he receives from the phone are choppy and quick, with terse military precision. They seem to have not the slightest whiff of bullshit in them.
"This is NORAD Command at Cheyenne. Who am I speaking with?"
"Lieutenant Frank White."
"Listen up, White. I don't have all the coordinates in front of me, but you are to clear all civilian aircraft south of Tampa and north of the Keys. Clear the deck up to the ceiling of 85,000 feet.
White looks at his shadowy reflection in the control tower glass and squints for a moment, picturing the area in his mind.
"Isn't that Everglades National Park?"
"Didn't hear that last transmission, son. What did you just say?"
"Oh, shit," Lieutenant White thought. "What is this? What's going on?"
I said, "Of course, sir. South of Tampa and north of the Keys."
In a moment, he is at one of the radar stations, working on carrying out the orders. The two-way crackles in his earpiece.
"Tower, this is 253. Our pre-flight is complete. Are we clear for takeoff?"
White sits up. 253 is the call sign for one of the B-2s.
"Yes, 253. You are clear on runway 1.
"Clear for what, I don't know," Lieutenant White thinks, slurping the dregs of his coffee as the massive aircraft begins to roll onto the airstrip. Chapter 77. NORAD Operations Center, Cheyenne Mountain Air Force Station, Colorado Springs, Colorado. When the all-hands-on-deck horn sounds throughout the compound that morning at 9 in the a.m., it can be heard clearly all the way down the mountain in the leafy suburbs of Colorado Springs. The newer residents of the town who notice the braying alarm may idly wonder if the siren is for the volunteer fire department before going back to their newspapers and breakfasts. Those who have family members working at the station immediately leave their jobs and yoga classes and head to the schools to gather their children. After exactly 5 minutes, the alarm ceases. Then the two 25-ton steel blast doors that protect the supposedly nuclear weapons-proof military bunker begin to close for the first time since 9/11. The corridors and rooms of the facility branch off a wide main tunnel, about as big as a train tunnel, that was bored almost through to the center of the granite mountain. The two-story glass-encased main operations center is at the end of the network of rooms nearest the mountain's westernmost slope. In it, Air Force techs sit at cubicles, calling orders into headsets as they listen to the squawk and crackle of military radio traffic. As one enters the room, the forward and right-hand walls are taken up with screens as big as the ones at the local multiplex. The forward screen shows computer maps and blinking radar scopes. The one at the right displays a flickering patchwork of multiple real-time feeds, a montage of ground-level images taken by cameras mounted on unmanned aircraft and warplanes currently aloft. Leaning against the stair rail outside the door of his fishbowl office, lofted above the operations center floor, NORAD Commander Michael McMarshall stands listening to the staff trading codes and coordinates back and forth. He whispers a furtive Hail Mary for his men and dry swallows the last three Advil out of the plastic bottle in his hand. McMarshall had been the CO during the first chaotic hours of 9/11, and this ball of wax is looking like it's going to be a mite bit worse. He returns to his office and stands behind his desk, an architect's drafting table ratcheted up to midriff level. At work, he always stands, due to a training flight crash that injured his back 30 years ago. He flips through a stack of photographs. The images are from the military's most advanced lacrosse satellites and unmanned aerial vehicles. Ground-penetrating radar and thermal infrared sensor systems have picked up some very disturbing data. Shockingly large pockets of animal swarms, as they are now being called, have aggregated in virtually every corner of the country. The initial wave of bombings has been ordered on the largest nests near densely populated areas. Miami, Chicago, and St. Louis are first on deck. If there's any good news at all, it's that the animal aggregations seem to be situated mostly in parklands, the Everglades near Miami, Lincoln Park in Chicago, Forest Park in St. Louis. They have been working with ground forces for the last 2 days, pulling evacs out of their target zones to limit collateral damage. So then, McMarshall pauses for a moment to reflect. The United States has just begun a bombing campaign on itself.
This is some catch-22 type shit. It's not just the United States, he knows. Russia, several European countries, and China are now working in sync, conducting their own campaigns against the animal swarms devastating their countries. They have to do something. Though people are being kept in the dark, the attacks have become rampant. In affected areas, which is pretty much everywhere now, the hospitals are full. People are holing up in their homes as though there were a plague afoot. Shipping, the airlines, the stock markets have all closed. The entire industrialized world is grinding to a halt, and it isn't going to be starting up anytime soon if everyone on Earth is in fear of being torn apart by dogs 24/7. McMarshall hears a polite knock on the glass.
The B-2 out of MacDill is about to deliver its payload, sir,
the spry young officer says with a gung-ho grin that's actually quite irritating under the circumstances. McMarshall's shoes clang on the metal balcony overseeing the operations room. The entire forward screen is filled with the image by the time the general arrives at the stair rail. Though it's a black-and-white thermal image, the clarity is startling. Why, look, there's Florida. McMarshall can make out palm fronds, a dock, an old car.
We are changing our heading for our final approach, the B-2 weapons officer says over the staticky military channel. And we are away, the weapons officer announces.
And the screen goes white. The boom of the daisy cutter through the pilot's open mic a moment later is a jagged roar that starts and then just keeps going on and on. The screen stays white as the Florida swampland burns.
Get some, McMarshall's aide shouts.
He whistles through his pinkies and starts to clap. Some of the other personnel join in tentatively. McMarshall pivots on his heel and heads back to his desk. There's an emergency bottle of Advil in the bottom drawer. Chapter 78. After Leahy arranged transportation for me back to New York, I spent the rest of the morning in a cramped, crowded, and distinctly unpresidential staff room in the back of the White House's East Wing. The whole place was in a full-tilt frenzy with the military actions underway. All around me, and even bivouacked out in the hallway, clustered by the electrical outlets, Air Force officers and politicos were working on their smartphones and laptops. Above their frantic murmur was a constant low thrumming, the rotor chop of helicopters landing and taking off in the Jacqueline Kennedy Garden. It was like my head was stuck in a beehive. A professionally nondescript Secret Service agent on break began snoring softly on a couch beside me as I watched CNN natter and flash on a TV bolted to an upper corner of the room. There were a lot of stories about the animal attacks, but nothing about the military response that had just been ordered. I wondered if that was because it hadn't happened yet, or because there was some kind of government news blackout. I guess that was possible now, I thought, glancing at the throng of soldiers and government officials around me. I tried to call Chloe several times to tell her what was going on, but the phone would only ring twice and go to voicemail, a sign I decidedly did not like. Text messages didn't seem to be working either. My guess was that it was probably circuit overload due to high call volume. That was my hope, anyway. Leahy came back for me in the early afternoon and ushered me through the crowd out into the hallway.
Unfortunately, no Gulfstream jet this time, Oz, but I did manage to get you on a military C-130 cargo plane heading out of Reagan National to New York in about 2 hours.
How's the military response going? Any word?
Your guess is as good as mine, Leahy said.
He led me down some stairs into a utility corridor.
They're still keeping me in the dark.
We passed stacks of K-rations and a chef in crisp whites cussing a blue streak into a cell phone on the way to the door. At the bottom of some steps was a small parking lot crowded with town cars and military vehicles. At the edge of the lot, standing beside the black Suburban that had brought me in, Sergeant Alvarez waved at me cheerily, as if the world weren't ending.
I'll keep plugging away on this end, Leahy said, shaking my hand and giving it a warm, paternal squeeze that was meant to be reassuring, and wasn't. In the meantime, when you get back to New York, prepare a presentation to explain the science of this to the president and her staff when they're ready to listen. That would be extremely helpful. I'm going to try to arrange a teleconference for this evening or tomorrow morning at the latest.
A teleconference? Splendid idea. Now why didn't I think of it? Oh, wait, I had.
I wondered how many thousands of tax dollars had been wasted on my useless trip down here. Then I made the decision not to care. Getting home to my family was my priority now. "Will do, Mr. Leahy," I said, making my escape. Chapter 79. Sergeant Alvarez was sitting in the driver's seat, locking and loading an M16, as I opened the passenger side door and climbed into the SUV. The VIP treatment was over. He was wearing Kevlar body armor now, and a grenade vest. He didn't have to explain to me that things were even worse now on the streets of D.C. I thought about Chloe and Eli back in New York, and I wished I was already airborne. We were two blocks south of the White House, about to make the left onto Constitution Avenue, when we heard music. Annie DeFranco yodeled from the crank speakers of a car parked at the corner of President's Park. Around it stood 30 or 40 young people, many in hoodies bearing their college insignias, drinking beer. Some of them had painted faces to look like animals. I smelled pot. They had handmade signs that read, "Meat is murder, ain't payback a bitch. Hi-ho, hi-ho, it's back to nature we go." Everything has gone nuts, I thought, shaking my head. Animals, the president, college kids. When we rolled past the National Mall again, I thought of all the noble historical assemblies the area had been host to. I thought of Martin Luther King Jr. delivering the I Have a Dream speech there, the presidential inaugurations. Now there were dead dogs floating in the reflecting pool. We took the Arlington Bridge back over the Potomac for the airport this time. About a half mile inbound, we came toward an overpass. Standing on it were what looked like more deluded young protesters. The college kids we'd seen back by the White House had mostly been harmless, but these guys looked more sinister in their ski masks and black bandanas. They were waving black flags. Then there was a flash of darting movement in front of the SUV, and the windshield caved in. Glass dust stung my eyes as the joint compound bucket somebody had dropped from the overpass whipped just past my head into the back seat. The SUV accelerated and veered to the left. I turned and saw that Alvarez's face was covered with blood. He was slumped over the steering wheel, motionless. I reached for the wheel, tried to right the vehicle. The car slid into the Jersey barrier at around 80. Metal shrieked and showered sparks as we lurched up and rode the barrier for 50 feet. Before the momentum flipped the truck. Chapter 80. Dark. At first, I thought the rhythmic thump, thump, thump was my heartbeat. Then I opened my eyes. I realized the noise was the windshield wipers beating uselessly against the shattered windshield. The truck's upside-down shattered windshield. The SUV had come to rest on its roof in the left lane. I was being held in place by my shoulder belt, dangling like a bat. I felt hot blood from my nose dripping into my hair. I sneezed and sprayed a mist of blood onto my one good suit. I blinked, staring out through the hole in the windshield. My thoughts were slow and oozy. So what now? I turned toward Alvarez. He was upside down like me, still unconscious and bleeding steadily from a gash in his temple. I reached out for a seatbelt and was stopped when I looked out the window. In between the steady slap of the wipers pushing glass crumbs into the car, I heard a strange huffing sound outside the passenger side window. Something was moving. I squinted at it. Brown, brown, brown. An enormous muzzle and small beady black eyes appeared in the window. Okay, I thought. That's a bear. It gazed through the window at me with an almost quizzical expression. What I was feeling wasn't even quite fear. What I was feeling was the fear equivalent of when you're so sad, you laugh. The wheel of fear went around a whole turn, came out the other side. I thought, well, this is it. How a grizzly bear had gotten here on this strip of road beside our wrecked truck was unclear. What it was doing in Washington, D.C. was unclear. Escape from the zoo? I had a feeling that it didn't work for AAA. It made its choppy huffing sound again and pressed its moist black snout against the glass of the car window. It sniffed at the glass and then made a low throaty moan as it scratched at the window with a paw twice the size of a catcher's mitt. The screech of the bear's claws on the glass snapped me out of my little absence seizure, Fumbling with my seatbelt release, I stretched an arm into the back seat, feeling for Sergeant Alvarez's rifle. I abandoned my search for the rifle as the bear moved from the passenger side to the front. I felt the truck lurch upward as the bear began squeezing himself under the upside-down hood. So this was how I will die, I thought, eaten by a grizzly while hanging upside down in a car wreck. Interesting, at least. If years before you'd gazed into a crystal ball and told me that was how I'd go, I genuinely would not have believed you. I turned to Alvarez and tried to shake him awake. For what reason, I didn't know. To wake him up for his death, I wasn't sure. I guess I didn't want to die alone. In any case, he was out for the night. The bear had shimmied its mass under the hood and was now nosing the hole the compound bucket had made. It sniffed and huffed as it began peeling back the shattered glass. The bear ripped at the glass as though it were a kid tearing into a stubborn candy wrapper. Then, I remembered the grenades that had dangled like avocados from the sergeant's vest. I unclipped the first one I could reach. I bit out its pin and tossed it at the bear as hard as I could as it poked its head in, below the upside-down dashboard. The bear roared and reared back as the hissing canister clanged off the side of its head. Interesting experience, having a bear roar in your face. The bear shook his head as if he'd been slapped. Instead of exploding, the canister came to a spinning stop on the asphalt under the hood and began pouring out canary yellow smoke. Roiling, acrid fumes burned my eyes. The smoke stung like a wasp stings. I covered my mouth as I coughed. I reached over to Alvarez and managed to wrench another grenade free from his vest. But by the time I was ready to throw it, I could see I didn't need it. Beyond the window, I saw the bear in retreat, bounding over the grass beyond the shoulder of the road. When the air cleared, a long minute later, I finally disentangled myself. Alvarez was hacking up a lung by the time I got him out of his seatbelt as well. We crawled out of the wreck. The SUV looked like John Belushi had crushed it against his forehead. "What the hell just happened?" Alvarez said, slouching against the Jersey barrier, touching his face and inspecting the blood on his fingertips. "It's just like bees," I said to myself, looking at the smoke billowing from beneath the truck. "What bees?" said Alvarez, rooting around in the wreck for his rifle. "You okay, Professor? You bang your head?" "When the animals smell us, they want to attack us," I said, crouching with him behind the overturned truck. "Anything that masks our scent makes us invisible. That's why the smoke drove off the bear. It knocked our scent out of the air." "No shit," Alvarez said absently, shouldering his gun. "It makes perfect sense," I said. I was thinking out loud. "Beekeepers use smoke in the same way. When the keeper shakes up a nest, the bees produce a pheromone that signals a mass attack, except nothing happens because the smoke disperses the signal."
"So that's what happened to all the animals, Professor. Why they swarm together? They've all, like, bugged out or something?"
"Exactly. They've all bugged out," I said. "Now call one of your marine buddies to get us the hell out of here. We need to tell them how to fight this thing."
Chapter 81. U.S. Army Manhattan Secure Zone, Upper East Side, New York City. The freight elevator is pretty rank even before Private First Class Donald Rodale starts collecting the garbage from the Fifth Avenue Emergency Government Residence that evening. By the time he's done, at 6:30, the lush, steamy aroma from the chest-high pile of greasy garbage bags is making his eyes tear and his lunch churn dangerously in his gut. Stopping the old manual elevator in the basement, a particularly slimy hefty cinch sack slides off the top of the pile and smacks him in the back of both legs with a wet spatter. Bullseye, Rodale thinks. Rodale opens the gate to the building's rear courtyard and begins carrying the garbage bags out one at a time, tossing them into a plastic rolling bin. When the bin is filled to its brim, he gets behind it and begins rolling it up a steep ramp leading to 81st Street. Huffing and slick with sweat, Rodale scowls when he makes it to the top of the ramp. The little security booth by the gate is empty. The guard at the booth is supposed to kill the juice on the electric fence and cover him with an M16 while he makes the journey across the street to toss the trash into the shipping container. But he's MIA. What to do? The guard who's usually at the booth is a cop named Quinlan, cool dude. He doesn't want to get him in trouble for not being at his post.
Problem is, if he waits around here any longer, he'll be late to help Suskind, a whiny prick if there ever was one, with the porta-potties across the street at the museum. He's damned if he does, and damned if he doesn't. Rodale looks down the long, dark corridor of East 81st through the chain-link fence. It's empty. Just a narrow lane of brick and granite townhouses, trees, empty sidewalks, no rabid packs of crazed animals. Nothing at all. Fuck it, Rodale thinks. Only take a second. He leans into the guard booth, hits the cutoff for the electrical gate, and swings it open. He pushes the garbage bin through. It makes a rattling, rumbling sound on the concrete as he pushes it off the curb toward the green corrugated fiberglass shipping container they're using for a dumpster. Rodale notices something funny when he reaches out to pull up the handle on the container door. It has already been pulled up. Had he forgotten to close it yesterday? The door yawns slightly open with a groan. He pushes it open all the way. The dark container stinks even worse than the freight elevator, like something rotting, something dead. Rodale holds his breath. He tips the bin over and starts tossing the bags as far back into the container as he can throw them. The heavy ones he grabs two-handed and kind of wheels around with them, like a discus thrower, to get some distance. He's almost having fun. When he's chucked about half the garbage bags, he hears a sound, like something moving. He's not looking in the container. He figures the sound was one of the bags he had just thrown rolling back toward the entrance. He lays his hands on the next bag, a heavy fucker, this one. Needs both hands. He's about to do his Olympic toss thing with it, and is reeling back, when from out of the shadows of the container's interior, there appears a chimpanzee. Rodale stands at the door, still holding the garbage bag. Yes, it is a chimpanzee. Face like a strange rubber mask, sweet lucid eyes like marbled brown glass. This chimpanzee is wearing a hat. The hat looks battered, threadbare, and filthy, but it looks like it was once red. It continues to stare right at him. It looks as if it's about to say something. In the last 2 weeks since all the crazy shit started, he's seen dogs attacking and rats. But a chimp? This is unexpected. Hey, he calls into the shipping container. His voice bounces off the narrow walls. He didn't know what else to say. Are you okay? As if in response, the chimpanzee grabs him by the shirt with its huge black hands, lurches forward, and bites off his nose. Rodale falls to his knees, the air pulling a scream like a long scarf from his throat. Blood dribbles over his lips and chin, between the fingers of the palms cupped to his face. The chimp makes a high, piercing call sound. From the townhouse beside the container, animals begin to emerge. They come from the windows, they come from the alleyways, from the brass mail slot in the red townhouse door. In five breaths, the street is crowded with mange-mottled feral dogs, raccoons, hundreds of cats. But by far the largest contingent is rats. Thousands upon thousands of plump, red-eyed rats. They make a living carpet out of the street, a squeaking black tide. Rodale runs, holding his face. He tries to run back to the fence. In mid-stride, the animals take him under. He sinks into the ocean of dogs and rats as if he's drowning. Like a drowning man, he flails and thrashes. The rats envelop him. They scurry over the backs of his legs, his arms, up the back of his shirt. He writhes on the ground, flailing, slapping, and punching at himself. From his groin to his chin, scissoring needle-like teeth are puncturing his skin, rending his flesh. In a moment, the rats are eating at muscle, at his organs. The thousands of tiny teeth snip through his tendons and then go to work stripping the meat from his bones. Attila spits out the soldier's nose and is knuckle-running at a loping cant across the street toward the open gate of the building. Behind him, the animal horde follows, snapping and howling. Chapter 82. The bag of popcorn in the droning microwave has begun to go from a few desultory pip-pops to a full-on clamor as Chloe chances upon a large plastic mixing bowl in the sprawling apartment's pantry. She takes note of a stash of instant soup boxes above the shelf where she just found the bowl. There is no way to tell how long they will be here in this place, so it's good to know where they stand with food. Things will get better eventually, she thinks, as she climbs back down the folding step stool. It's just a matter of holding out. Arriving back into the bright marble kitchen, for a moment she takes small solace in the aroma of butter and salt, a smell that conjures up family, happiness, safety. It doesn't work. Her resolve, wavering all day, evaporates. She flings away the bowl and covers her face with her hands. The comforting scent is a mockery now. There will be no more comfort, she knows. Her family is separated. No one is happy. No one is safe. Though she has never told Oz about it, she had panic attacks in grad school that had been serious enough for her family to convince her to see a therapist. It took almost a year of hard work and a brief hospitalization to finally conquer them. Since Oz left, she has felt them creeping back. The same itching fear, the same paralysis, the same pathological self-condemnation. Worthless, says an inner voice as she bends over the countertop, shivering. Worthless, as a wife, a mother, a woman, a human being. Only two things will happen now. She will get her son killed. Then she will get herself killed. The bone-drilling shriek of the microwave timer brings her back out of the hole she's fallen into. She squeezes the cold edge of the marble countertop until her knuckles whiten to the color of soapstone. She wipes her tears with the back of a hand and checks her face in the glass-fronted cabinet above the sink. She dumps the steaming popcorn into the bowl and heads back into the living room. In the cavernous room, Eli sits cross-legged on the oriental carpet, gazing up, wide-eyed, at the monolithic flat-screen TV on the wall. A rerun of The Simpsons is on. Homer runs from an out-of-control car. To escape, the cartoon character dives into a manhole, only to do a faceplant on a hot steam pipe. Under ordinary circumstances, she wouldn't let Eli watch TV that wasn't at least vaguely educational. Under these circumstances, though, Chloe kneels down and hugs her son, inhales his smell, listens to him giggle.
I like this fat yellow man, Mommy, Eli says.
Chloe kisses her son on the top of his head and remembers something. One of the therapies that she used to keep her panic attacks away was exercise. She had started going to the gym every night after school to swim laps before dinner. It cleared her head. It worked. She doesn't want to leave Eli at all these days. In fact, she feels like attaching him to herself in a papoose, as she did when he was an infant. But her anxiety is buzzing in her skull like a power drill. Her little meltdown in the kitchen proved that. If they are going to survive, she needs to calm down. She needs to be strong.
Hey, Eli, baby, listen,
she says, setting the popcorn in front of him as though it were an offering for an idol.
Mommy's going to exercise now in the room on the other side of the kitchen, okay?
Okay,
he says automatically. His eyes are fixed in an absent dreamland glaze on the TV. His tiny, smooth hand digs unthinkingly into the popcorn, then delivers a fistful to his mouth. She is in the small workout room, about to embark the treadmill, when she hears a sound, coming from the window. It is a soft, distant crackling, almost like the microwave popcorn cooking. She slowly walks to the front of the apartment. She hears more sounds as she opens the door to the hallway. A kind of strange chugging sound starts up, coming from one of the lower floors, followed quickly by a violent knocking, as if a stone fist is banging on a locked door. Chloe bites her lip hard enough to draw blood. Gunfire, she thinks. Someone is shooting. She slams the apartment door hard enough to topple a vase from an antique table beside her, her heart chugging in time to the machine guns as her fingers turn the locks. Chapter 83. We had to wait around a while before we were picked up and taken away from the place where our SUV had crashed. Being out in the open while we waited was a strange feeling, simultaneously boring and terrifying. The whole time I stood on the highway median, leaning on the smashed truck as I looked up and down the flat, empty highway through the side of Alvarez's M16, praying we wouldn't see another animal. A Humvee with a roof rack full of blazing lights finally arrived about 15 minutes after we'd called. Two Marines jumped out. There was a dead St. Bernard lashed to its hood with bungee cords. They were taking trophies now. This was war. I wondered who was winning.
The fuck took you so long?
Said Alvarez.
Attacks are everywhere now, Sarge,
said the driver, a wiry black man with haunted-looking eyes.
We had to shoot our way out here. The Pentagon got hit. Reagan Airport is completely overrun by a swarm of dogs. The hangars, the terminal, everywhere. No planes in or out until the situation gets dealt with.
Terrific. No flights, I thought, as we carefully laid Alvarez, bloody as a butcher's apron and spitting curses, across the back seat of the Hummer. Now how the hell was I going to get home? I was stuck. The driver pounded the gas and floored us back to the Marine Corps base next to the White House. We didn't encounter any more animal hordes directly, but down alleyways, side streets, inside windows, we could see movement, shadows scurrying. The whole city felt infested now. Relatively safe back inside the base and the packed medical tent, I was getting stitches in my elbow when an attractive petite woman with reddish-brown hair came in. She carried a walkie-talkie and had a White House security badge clipped to the lapel of a pricey blazer.
Is there a Jackson Oz here?
She called out.
I'm looking for a Mr. Jackson Oz.
I sat there a moment in silence while she trawled the medical tent. What did they have in store for me now, I thought. An IRS audit, perhaps? I'd come down here in order to help, and all I'd gotten to show for it was being stranded and separated from my family as the world dissolved into chaos. Oh, and a car wreck, 20 stitches and a bear. But as the redhead was turning to leave, I called out to her.
I'm Jackson Oz, I said. What do you need?
Her eyebrows danced as she lifted her walkie-talkie.
I found him,
she said into the radio.
I'll bring him straight away.
Bring me where? I said.
Rihanna Morton, Deputy Cabinet Secretary, she said, offering a hand.
Bring me where, I repeated.
A cabinet meeting is adjourning as we speak,
Miss Morton said.
Mr. Leahy said you have a presentation?
5 minutes later, I was back inside the White House compound, hurrying with the staffer past the flower beds and boxwoods of the Jacqueline Kennedy Garden. We went through a basement door and up some stairs and turned to the right down a majestic paneled corridor, lined with fireplaces, antique bookcases, bronze busts. I guess this isn't another runaround after all, I thought, as I realized we were walking through the White House's west wing. In the cabinet room vestibule, a hulking Marine in dress blues checked my ID with a white-gloved hand. Among the crowd of suits behind him, I saw the Vice President and the Secretary of State. They were joking around with each other, something that involved sticking post-it notes onto the blackberries they weren't allowed to bring into the meeting. Outside, the nation's capital was melting down, probably the world, too. But the well-protected politicians were sharing a pleasant bon mot. No wonder people liked Washington, D.C. so much, I thought. Chapter 84. I heard a friendly voice behind me call my name. There was a soft sound of electric buzzing, and the crowd of suits parted as Charles Groh hummed up to me in his wheelchair. I grasped his hand.
Finally, a friendly face, I said. What's the word? You hear anything?
Are you okay, Oz?
I remembered that I was filthy and covered in blood. My sleeves were rolled up and my loosened tie dangled absurdly down the front of my blood-speckled button-down.
I'm fine. Car crash, bear attack. I'll tell you later. Any news from the world?
It didn't work, Oz,
Dr. Groh said as I followed his wheelchair from the security line to the other side of the hallway. The bombing campaign was nothing more than a lot of sound and fury, signifying jack shit. Now that they're done with their temper tantrum, they want to hear from us. We should take a minute to compare notes, I said, motioning Dr. Groh toward the corner of the room.
Sounds good, Oz,
he said, producing a thin gray MacBook Air from a leather satchel dangling off his chair.
These are thick skulls we're going to have to try to get through.
Aides were sitting like ducks along both walls of the cabinet room when we came in some 15 minutes later. Rihanna Morton directed me to a chair at the end of the oblong table farthest from the door. As she tipped a pitcher of ice water into the glass in front of me, I noticed there were several glossy monitors set up on rolling carts. The Chancellor of Germany was on one of them, whispering with an aide. On another screen was the British Prime Minister.
This meeting will be video conferenced with several world leaders, Miss Morton explained. The paramount leader of China should be online in a moment. As I tried, unsuccessfully, not to let that information rattle my chain, President Hardinson arrived. Everyone in the room who had been seated shot to their feet, except for Dr. Groh. It was the first time I'd seen President Marlena Hardinson in person. She did have a remarkably arresting presence, this slightly heavy-set woman with smoky bags under her dark green owlish eyes, which had an almost intimidating intelligence in them. She was stately in pearls and a midnight blue blazer.
"Okay, everyone,"
Hardinson said, waving the people to their seats. Her voice had that familiar husky rasp that I'd heard on TV 1,000 times before, but it was an odd feeling to hear it in the flesh. She smiled as she sat down at the center of the table. Her smile had no warmth in it. I reminded myself that her teenage daughter had died yesterday, and that I wasn't supposed to know that.
"Mr. Oz, Dr. Groh," she said, nodding to us. "Please, tell us what you know."
All eyes were on me. I sucked in a deep breath.
"Thank you, Ms. President," I said.
"Everyone, my name is Jackson Oz, and for the last 10 years I've been researching the aberrant animal behavior now known as HAC. Animal attacks on people have been around as long as people have been around, but over the last 15 years or so, we began noticing a startling, exponential increase of animal-on-human violence. Coupled with this increased aggression, animals also began exhibiting behavior uncharacteristic not only of their particular species, but also of mammals in general. All over the world, as I'm sure you've noticed by now, animals are aggregating in swarms or hordes and attacking human beings en masse. This is not happening at random. Animals are forming into insect-like swarms."
"Insects," said the Secretary of Defense. "Why? And why now?"
Charles Groh cut in.
"Inadvertent man-made changes to the environment, sir," he said, clicking his laptop to control the PowerPoint display.
I waited for the hydrocarbon graph to pop up on the screen before continuing. "Recently, human beings have caused two things to become prevalent in the environment that weren't around before. Electromagnetic radiation and the byproducts of petroleum. Petroleum is an organic compound made up mostly of hydrocarbons. We believe that in the last 15 years, the explosion of electromagnetic radiation due to cell phone use has begun cooking, if you will, the hydrocarbons that are all around us, ultimately changing their chemical makeup. This new hydrocarbon mimics animal pheromones, but it's stronger. It's this pheromone-like pollutant that's making the animals go haywire. In essence, we believe that because we have changed the way the environment smells, animals have changed the way they behave."
"Pheromones?" the Secretary of State piped in. "I thought they only worked with insects or something."
Charles Groh shook his head.
"Many animals respond to pheromones. Communication, food gathering, mating behavior, aggression, all these things involve scent. That may be one reason why dogs in particular have been so susceptible. Their sense of smell is 100,000 times stronger than ours."
"But why are they just attacking us?" said the president. "Why not each other?"
"That's where another factor comes in," I said. "It seems that due to all the petroleum-based products we use, the human scent actually seems to now be mimicking an attack pheromone. The animals are being drawn to us with the same automatic ferocity of wasps in a disturbed nest."
said
the president. It was almost a harumph.
"Toxic pheromone pollution. How can we combat that?"
Charles Groh and I looked at each other. This was it. We'd finally arrived at the hard part. What had to be done? "The first step," I said, "would be removing the factors that are causing the environmental disturbance."
"Remove petroleum products?"
said the president.
"And cell phones?" said the Secretary of State.
I nodded at both of them, then looked out at the faces around the table and on the screens.
"Desperate times, ladies and gentlemen," I said.
"Here's what I think we should do."
Chapter 85. Straining her ears, her eyes glued to the front door she just double-locked, Chloe sits on a creaking Louis XIV chair in the entryway of the apartment.
For the last half hour, she sat listening as gunfire cracked and rollicked throughout the building, thudding through the walls and echoing in the hallways. The noises keep getting louder, rising floor by floor like a fire. Soon it will reach their floor, and she and her son will be consumed. And yet, all she could do is sit there. The wild fear is so great that she is almost immobilized now. She can't act, can't think, can't plan her next move. All she can do is sit and stare at the crack of light beneath the door, wondering what will happen next. The pressure in her tightly clenched jaw seems to double, triple, when she hears a sound that is clearly in the hallway outside the apartment. It's a brief creak, followed by a click. Then she hears it again, creak and click. Something is pushing at the stairwell door in the hallway, she realizes. Probing. It's something that isn't human. Or even really animal anymore, she thinks. It's true. What they are up against is something that has never been seen before. She has thought of it as devolution. It is as if the nature of every higher animal has been erased and replaced with the alien instinct of the insect world, an instinct older, more terrible, more pitiless than human beings have ever seen. She thinks about her career as a biologist, all the tireless work, the cataloging of animal species and genera. It has all been made useless now. All animals are joining into one, a roving amalgam of fur and bone and teeth, no different from any other wave of destructive energy. What is happening is like a lava flow, a raging inferno of animated protoplasm that seeks the same thing as fire itself, to initiate change, to consume until the thing consumed is gone, to devour. Why is this happening? Who knows, really? Life and existence can never be fully understood. Stars are born only to explode. Creatures hunt other creatures, and then they die. The universe is a chaos of irrational forces wrestling with one another in a war without end. The human race is on the receiving end now. Chloe finally stands. On legs as stiff and unresponsive as stale bread, she returns slowly into the living room. Eli is still planted, glassy-eyed, before the television. On the TV, there's a cartoon movie of friendly animals talking to each other. Madagascar, comes a useless thought, like a bird flying through the opaque cloud of her fear. She looks for the remote to turn off the TV, gives up, and clicks it off by pressing the button on the set itself.
What's wrong, Mommy?
Eli says, stars in his eyes. He's an impressively smart kid, obedient, especially perceptive of her feelings, especially when she isn't fooling around. She lifts him up. She goes to the corner of the living room and switches off the light. She sits on one of the plush white couches, beneath a canvas that screams with garish splashes of color. Here it is, her grand plan, she thinks. Soon she hears a skittering by the front door. Or has she imagined it? I will not let you in, Chloe thinks. Not by the hairs of my chinny-chin-chin. Her hands are shaking violently. She clenches her fists to make them stop.
What's wrong, Mommy?
Eli whispers.
You have to listen to me, Eli,
Chloe whispers back.
We have to be quiet now. Can you do that? Can you be a good boy for Mama? Yes,
Eli says, squeezing her hand.
Don't be sad, Mommy. I can be quiet.
She tries to regulate her breathing, to breathe with steady deliberation. She tries to will down the throbbing in her stomach and her chest and her brain. Tears well under her cheekbones. She tries to dam them back. Her vision blurs. Think. Control. The world is receding into focus. Keep it there. Control it. Control it. She thinks, trying to come up with a rational next step. She thinks about the building. There is a set of front stairs, an elevator, a freight elevator. Wait, she thinks. There's also a set of back stairs, which might be accessible from the kitchen door in the rear, where she tosses the trash. Maybe that escape route is still open, she thinks. She could carry Eli and get out that way. But then what? Be out in the open? Go to another building? The best thing to do is just sit here and hope they are ignored, and... Another sound makes her heart skip a beat. It is coming from off to her right. There is a set of French doors there. She has forgotten about them. They lead out to a balcony. She watches a shadow fall onto the balcony from above, just outside the glass. Then another.
then a third. Slowly, Chloe pulls Eli to the floor with her, lying on her belly beside the coffee table with him, clutching him to herself, trying to protect him with her body as best she can. She raises her head very slowly until she can see the French doors and the balcony again. There are three adult chimpanzees with their faces squished against the glass, blowing hot fog on it, like children pressing their faces to the window of a candy store. They are huge. Their fur is bristling, erect. Two of them hold something in their hands. Sticks? No, they are pipes. Tool use, the ethologist still left in Chloe thinks. The sound of tapping comes a moment later. The chimps are hitting the pipes against the glass doors. Clink, clink, clink. Then, there is a cymbal crash burst of glass breaking. Chapter 86. Glass shatters. Jagged triangles tumble piecemeal to the wooden floor, clang, clatter, and chime. The chimps clear the glass from the frames with the pipes. The alpha male steps forward, gently shoving the others out of the way. He is wearing a ragged red hat, rakish and totemic on his head, like a barbarian scavenged crown. It is Attila, or what used to be Attila. He is a changed ape. There is a tightly wound, guitar-string tautness to his musculature, a ravenous, lean and hungry look. His hair is rangy in places, his nose is running. It seems his whole physiology has changed. His brain functions are dulled, perverted, his metabolism stuck in fast forward. Attila sticks his face into the apartment, sniffs. All is smell now. Sound, touch, even sight play second fiddles in the orchestra of sensation. They all know there are humans here. They all know there is an adult female. That scent is unmistakable. The sweat, the sweet, tiny reek of ovulation. And what smells like a young juvenile. Their mouths tingle with salivation at the proximity of the prey. They want to feed on them the way fire wants oxygen. The animals communicate almost exclusively by smell now. Emotions and intentions are detectable in body odor, in sweat. Attila wants it even more than the two others with him. He hasn't had a fresh kill in hours, and the hunger gnawing at his belly is as scissors in his stomach, cutting him in half. Attila is about to enter the room from the balcony when he catches another scent. There is something subtle in the human smell of the other one, the young one. Something very, very subtle that pokes thinly through the wall of his rage. Across the red screen of Attila's mind, a memory plays. A man's face appears, vague, watery, but there. It comes down close to the bars of the tiny cramped cage he is trapped in. The man opens the door of the cage, cradles him, talks to him, soothes him. The first kindness he ever experienced. Rocking his dazed head from side to side at the strange vision, Attila stops in the shattered balcony doorway. He is in there, somehow. Somehow a part of the boy. And yet Attila is angry. So angry. He stands there, his impulses warring with his memory. The other two apes, squirming with blood rage, struggle to squeeze past him. Attila grabs the first one by the shoulder, and then the other. He draws them away from the doorway back into the outside. There is other meat. Attila shrieks. It is a violent noise, high-pitched, grinding. Chapter 87.
Mommy! Mommy! Wake up! Listen!
Chloe's eyes flutter open. There is a high, ear-piercing primate call sound coming from the balcony. The chimps on the balcony seem to be tussling with one another. She sits up. Chloe reaches out and wraps her arms firmly around her son. As they watch the animals jostle,